Good morning. My name is Larissa, and I'm a compulsive eater. I never get tired of saying that. I never thought I'd say that. I don't ever get tired of saying that. Let's have a moment of silence, please. Just be quiet and get still within ourselves. And close our eyes if you want to, and just meditate for a few minutes on being together, being in community and communion with one another. Let's have grateful, gratitude hearts for this ability and the blessing and the love of whomever you call your higher power for being here and for bringing us together again this year. It's been a long time. And think about going back out into the world and carrying the message of recovery to those who still suffer, those who are on their way, and for our families who do not understand that we have been in this place this weekend. Now, as you come back into this room with your eyes open, let's have the understanding and love that it is a gift, G-I-F-T, from the universe of your source that has got us here and just keeping us here together in love. Again, I am Larissa, compulsive eater, and I'm so grateful to be here this morning with you. Grateful to be able to have the honor and the privilege of giving the service that I, whatever little service I can give, in the spirit of love. I'm honored to introduce the speaker this morning from Albuquerque, New Mexico, Barbara.
Good morning. My name is Barbara. I'm a compulsive eater from Albuquerque, New Mexico. How's everybody doing this morning? You know, I was thinking to myself, there's probably going to be four people here because everybody's at the airport, and holy crap, there's a lot of people here. And I haven't talked in front of a group of people in a while, but you know what? You give a disc jockey a microphone and magic happens. 35 years in front of a microphone going, that was Celine Dion. You know, you can take the girl out of the radio, but you can't take the radio out of the girl. I found in this recovery, I'll qualify real quick before I jump in. My abstinence date is January 1st, 2003. I came into the rooms of compulsive eaters recovery in 1987 through OA. Right now I'm in the maintenance process on a 99-pound weight loss overall. That's by the grace of God. I can promise you that any diet I ever started ended at 10 a.m. And I did them all. Back in the 70s, I was a kid in the 70s, born in 1963, do the math, I'm 58. But I was a fat kid, about a year. I'm sending pictures around. That's one of the things we don't get to do on the phone bridge. And you know, that's kind of nice. It's like, oh my God, we have illustrations. And I was a normal-sized kid at about a year and a half old, and then things started to change. And I'm pretty sure something must have happened. I've done 3 years of regressive hypnosis and a lot of therapy, and I can't find conscious memories. I know I've got some grave emotional and mental disorders, so I'm sure there's a fabulous denial system that's in place that's kept those blocked. But I can tell you that if it walks like a duck and it talks like a duck, it's probably a friggin' duck. But I came into these rooms honestly. By about a year and a half, I was getting to be a chubby kid. One of my earliest memories around food was about 3 years old. And at that point, I was in rural Pennsylvania. I was around upstate New York. And I remember being put in a playpen with a bunch of kids, standing with my mouth open like a baby bird, trying to get my mother to drop breakfast meat into my mouth. And she did once, and I said, "Mommy, more, mommy, more, mommy, more." And she's like, "I can't give you more." Well, my whole life has been more. By the time I was in fifth grade, did you ever have to go and get weighed? Who went through that? Is that hell on earth? Oh, dear God in heaven. Whoever decided to do that had it out for me, I'm convinced. I would, you know, we all had to stand in line for that thing in front of everybody else, and they'd say the number out loud. Well, when they got to mine, they would whisper it, which was even worse, you know? I mean, they were trying to be sensitive, but dear God in heaven, it was awful. And in fifth grade, I was 197 pounds. Sixth grade, I was 192 pounds, so I wasn't a compulsive eater. Of course, that word wasn't on my radar until I came into these rooms. I got into junior high, and that was my own personal hell, and if I could have paid off somebody to do puberty for me, I would have. I mean, I spent my life wearing blue polyester pants, a dark blue sweatshirt. I wasn't going to wear a bra because I didn't want to grow up, because I had this idea in my head that if I grew up, my parents would die. Don't ask me where that came from. But I was desperately afraid to grow up, and I wanted to be a boy because the boys had power, the girls had no power. And so it went. And I got into junior high, and I got on a commercial weight loss program. Not Weight Watchers. It was called Lean Line. I think it was regional. Does anybody remember Lean Line? Anybody know about that one? See, I think it was just a certain area. And I remember the billboard. It said, "The best place to start a diet," and it had the lady's head. So my mother and I both went on Lean Line. It was right after my grandmother passed. And I was not in touch with my feelings, but I was vaguely aware that I had said, "Screw it, what the hell, there's no point," and really began to eat in earnest at that point. And that was when I got up to 230 pounds. And I got on this commercial weight loss program. And I was weighing and measuring with the doctor. And, well, not the doctor, that was the second time around, but I was weighing and measuring my food, and I was losing weight like crazy. Funny, it's like a precursor to what I'm doing here. Apparently, weight and measured plan was a good thing, but back then, there was no emotional component to it. So here I was doing this thing and being the star. I mean, academically, I was a smart kid, but where I grew up and how I grew up and the way I felt, you had to be more than an academic star. You had to look good in your jeans, and you had to be thin. And so I always felt like I was behind the eight ball. And I realized that there was a temporal component to that, because when I started school, I missed the cutoff date by 10 days. I was born November 10th, cutoff date was October 31st, so guess what? I started school a year later. I'm going to be the bigger girl. But it never occurred to me until, like, in the last few years, that time was working against me, and I just, you're just a fat kid. You're just a fat kid. You know, this is the stuff in my head. So fast forward to junior high, and I was miserable. I was depressed about my grandmother. I found out later I was depressed, had real live depression. I think Bill W. did too. And so at that point, I had lost 52 pounds in 6 months. I was wearing my stretch jeans because we didn't have Torrid and all those great places they have now for large size girls to shine and be their best self. No. I was in the men's department clothes. I was in the maternity department clothes. God, it was just miserable. And now I can buy clothes. It's really fun. But at that time, I had lost this weight. I was in stretch dress jeans. That's what we called them. But they were denim. You know, wow, I was wearing denim. And then the feelings started to come up. And it was, you know, I was riding high on the weight loss. Look at me, you know. And then the feelings started to come up, and I had no vocabulary for those. I had grown up with the idea that if you lose weight, everything's going to be okay. Anybody familiar with that? Amazing. That's the one thing we have in common, right? Maybe a couple other things too. And I didn't count on these strange feelings to come up. And I couldn't verbalize them. It was like one big knotted ball of yarn. And all I knew was it was like an atomic bomb in there. Something was happening. I have no idea what I'm going to do with this, you know. And I got more and more frightened and more terrified. And I, again, can't put words to this because all we have is the diet. We don't have any kind of emotional component. Fast forward to Christmas time, and I got up out of bed. I was not feeling well. I had, you know, like I said, lost this weight. And I walked out of my room, and I was really dizzy. I went into the bathroom. My mother started to walk me back to the bedroom. And I passed out cold from a standing position and hit my head on the corner of a round-edged desk, went straight out. And when I came to, I had blood all over me, and it was quite dramatic. Turned out I had viral pneumonia and 104-degree temperature. And I wound up spending a week in the hospital. And I tell you this story because it was kind of a hitting bottom situation. At that point, my temperature was 104 degrees. I was burning up. My lungs were compromised because I couldn't take in air. I couldn't take in life. And if you think about the body-mind connection, what was this all saying? And dizzy. Don't want to look at the truth. So, you know, in the early 80s or the late 80s, that body-mind connection became a real big theme in the recovery world. And we began to see and kind of connect the different aspects of when we behave this way or when we have this condition, it may be related to this idea system. I didn't want to look at life. I didn't want to take in life. It was too painful. And I was burning up with anger. But that moment was the turning around of the locomotive. At that moment, I realized I wanted to live. I didn't want to die, but I had no clue what or how that was going to manifest. I just knew that was where it was. So that was around 1979. 1981, we're making noises. Like, I'm growing up in New Jersey, okay? And here we are living in New Mexico now. My mother says to me, "What would you think if we moved to New Mexico?" New Mexico. This was about as likely as, "What would you think if we decided to move into a domed habitat on Mars?" We were going to live and die in New Jersey. That was all there was. You know, I come from immigrant parents. You know, their parents. One side came over from Hungary. The other side, much to my utter astonishment, was German. I thought my last name is Fox. I thought I was Irish. Turns out it's from the German Fuchs from Wiesbaden. The things you learn when somebody does your genealogy. So maybe that explains the sauerkraut. So 1981, November, my mother sends me on a plane to New Mexico, to Albuquerque, to scope it out. What the hell does an 18-year-old know about looking at a house in Albuquerque? It had two bathrooms. It was good enough for me. I was going to have my own bathroom. I was stoked. That was a good thing. And that was my first taste of a geographic cure. I thought, okay, I can go there, and no one knows, because I was down to 180 trim pounds on my 5'5" body. I was styling and profiling. And it turned out those Spanish guys in New Mexico liked those women with those big hips. And I was like, yes, I got a chance. They don't have to know I was the fat girl from New Jersey. So I was okay with that. Until I got there and eventually took a bite, because I got on the scale and it said 179. And when that happened, all hell broke loose because I didn't know how to deal with that number. And I mean, I stepped off the scale and opened the freezer and took out the first frozen thing with a stick on it. And that began the party again. And that continued until I walked into the rooms the first time. And the only reason I walked into those rooms is because I was surrounded by a bunch of damn alcoholics at the radio station that I worked at. They were all in recovery. They were either in NA or AA. And I thought, well, crap, these guys are a bunch of game players, you know? What am I going to do around these alcoholics? And I was dating a cowboy at the time who weighed more than I did. That's a very important thing. And he was telling me he didn't drink. And I believed him. And then somebody ratted him out. He was drinking at the club. And his sister-in-law said to me, Barbara, he wouldn't lie to you if he didn't love you. Let's let that sink in for a minute. Okay? Once again, I'm standing at that juncture. Do I live or do I die? Do I close my ears and go, la, 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 he's cute, he dances, and just go with it? Or do I face that excruciating pain of, I can't live with a liar? Well, I said, I can't live with a liar. And it hurt. It hurt so much. It hurt unbelievably. That was in 1986, 1987, I found my way into the rooms. And for the first time in my life, I heard the white noise in my ears. I did not know there was all kinds of stuff going on in there. And the only reason I went was because my damn program director said to me, I think you have a problem with food. The nerve of that SOB. I wanted that job more than I wanted the food. That's the only reason I consented to go to a meeting, because I thought I would please him. I looked at him. Of course, I was in my one pair of pants that still fit, busting out of them. And I said, I'm aware of it. I'll take care of it. And the SOB was silent. And the news girl, who was in NA, took me to my first meeting. And I sat in that meeting and I heard people that I swore were peeking in my window talking about the things they did with food. And I got more and more uncomfortable because I really thought, it almost felt like it was all being staged. This is, you know, when you're an egomaniac with an inferiority complex, you think everybody's talking about you. And I'm listening to this and I'm going, shit, they're talking about me. Pulling stuff out of the trash. Eating spoiled stuff. Just the things we do, shoving it into our mouth. No, we're not supposed to talk about that. You know, we don't talk about that. We might do it, but we don't talk about it. And these people are telling the secrets. The meeting got done. And there was no place to hide. And the girl that took me to the meeting came up to me, and I was so pissed at myself. I hugged her, and I started bawling uncontrollably. Could not stop. And I said, oh my God. I was mortified. She says, it's okay. We'll love you until you learn to love yourself. And I thought, what a bunch of hokey BS that is. And part of me said, shut up, Barbara. This is what you need. And my soul just grabbed it like the dying sees a life preserver, because it was exactly what I needed. And I was completely unaware of this gaping Grand Canyon of need, which was a spiritual need that I had no concept of, because all I knew was third density world, 3D reality. You push yourself away from the table, you follow the diet like everybody else does, and you have willpower. Anybody here know about willpower? Anybody have a problem with willpower? Yeah. Yeah. It's that thing, you know? I remember my neighbor, I could kill her. She said to me, Barbara, just don't eat. What the hell, just don't eat? Why don't you tell me to just hold my breath until I friggin' turn blue? That ain't gonna happen. I mean, my God, I'm wired to eat. So I got into this meeting and things began to change, and I got a pink cloud. And that pink cloud lasted for 8 years. 8 years. I mean, I dropped weight like I was just, you know, peeling stuff, peeling the wrapping off the orange, you know? It was amazing. And I was given all the, quote, right answers for the questions and doing all the work and stuff. And I thought I was pretty hot stuff. And I even got married to a guy who weighed more than I did, and he was gorgeous. That lasted 4 years. And getting ahead of myself. But it was, you know, it was a kind of amazing thing because it was really kind of a star type thing, you know, at the time. At that point, I had the job I wanted. I was doing all the right things. The station went number one. And it was a very heady brew having no self-esteem and getting it from the outside. And then really getting it and becoming like a household name. I mean, minor league celebrity in Albuquerque. But more than I would have had ever, ever, ever. And certainly going from being reviled and taunted as a child in school to having people walk up and ask for an autograph. It's like, oh my God, you know, there's too much extreme in there. There was never a middle ground where I was spiritually centered with a higher power and right-sized. It was just those extremes. And so that was the first 8 years of recovery, and then things went to hell in a handbasket. The marriage ended. The weight came back on. I had gotten down to 146 pounds. Yeah, and I was something. And then the feelings came up, and the marriage started to crumble, and I was really something after that. And it was devastating, you know. So 8 years, eight more years in that other program, I'm going, wait a minute. All this wonderful stuff going on, and now I got this? This is supposed to be the last house on the block. What am I going to do now? And my sponsor in that program later came to tell me that what had happened is I had become a food lawyer. Do you know what food lawyers are? Food lawyers are the ones that find all the loopholes. Okay? It's a self-defined abstinence. Yep, I can't take credit for that. That's my sponsor. But when the going gets tough, the tough change their food plan. I had given up sugar in that program and did fairly well with it. Then I picked up alcohol. I didn't realize alcohol was high-speed sugar. All of a sudden, I'm buying these drinks with umbrellas in them and paying $5 at the nightclub. It's like, what the hell is this? This is expensive. And I'm drinking beer. I don't like beer. But why am I drinking it? Finally, it's like the light bulb goes on because I'm too cheap to keep paying for these drinks. It's like, don't do this, Barbara. This isn't going to do you any good because I was a cheap drunk. I would, you know, and I didn't know. I never picked up alcohol to any great extent until I put the sugar down. Then the light bulb goes on. They're like, hey, leave that alone. So May 4th, 1989, we put the alcohol down, and the sugar's gone. But the flour is still ever so present and in every basket on the table, you know? And boy, howdy, I'm availing myself of it because I'm free of sugar. I didn't know what virtue signaling was until just recently because I'm hearing that term, but I guess that was virtue signaling. And so, you know, I don't eat sugar. Yeah. But please, hand me that basket right there. And, oh, that too, you know, and it's gone. Can we have some more of this, please, before the meal comes? And that's how we did that. So then my sponsor did the ultimate thing and went over to the dark side. This woman from California moved into our town, and she made a lot of sense at our meetings while I was busily complaining that our program wasn't working. And she made sense. Well, little did I know she came from this program called CHOW. And I thought, you know, she's got something. She's got something. And I'm listening, and I'm thinking, this isn't good. This isn't good. Something's going to have to change. And I thought, you know, the last thing I want to do is give up my food. I just want to be thin. I just want to be thin. I'll do certain things, but please don't make me give up my food. And then I see her hand my sponsor a can of pumpkin. You should try it. Oh, my God. Oh, my God, no, please. It was like Darth Vader going, come to the dark side. Please, no, please, no. Because I knew I was going to have to surrender the food. And I came in to the other program in 1987 when they had said that food plans were a violation of Tradition 3. I had no idea what that meant, but if it meant I didn't have to be on a food plan, I'm down with that. Food plans are a violation of Tradition 3. It's a diet mentality. Don't do it. Don't do it. It was a perfect excuse. I had no idea about the other side of it, but by God, I was going to make sure I could define my own food plan, not because it would be good for me, but because Who wants to do that weighing and measuring crap? And then she says, try it. And I'm like, oh my God, this is awful. I'm going to turn into a Stepford wife. That's a dated reference. Does anybody, who's too young to know what a Stepford wife is? You don't know? You're lying. Have that nice lady next to you who's being honest explain it to you. So I figured I was going to become this little robot, you know. If I gave up my food and put it on a scale and you know, only relegated myself to this minute selection, I was screwed. I was screwed. This isn't good. And so here we are, sitting in the first CEHOW meeting. And of course, you know, when they said CEHOW, it pissed me off. It is CEAHOW, because I got to have control. I don't want you telling me how the slang goes, because I'm scared and I want control. And so I'm listening to this, and of course I can't talk because I got 30 days. I gotta have 30 days, right? And I'm thinking, you people don't understand. I've been in another program for 16 years. I know what I'm talking about. And I'm sitting there with this self-righteous on my face, not holding still. You know, somebody later reflected to me that I was like, because I was like, God only knows what was running through my system at the time. It might have been flour. And I was agitated as hell at what they were saying, and I couldn't talk, and I was pissed about that. So I'm sitting there. And then it was such a small meeting and so new to our town that we didn't really have that many people who were abstinent and could share. So at the end, they closed it and opened it. Well, that's when I let my tirades out. I spared no expense. I let them know exactly what I thought. And somewhere in the course of mid-2002, while all of this was going on, I was just basically screwing with the food plan and just doing all kinds of weird experimentation. Somewhere in the course of that, I began to do it the way it was written. And it was really a very gradual thing. My sponsor was extremely patient with me. And something happened. I began to feel what it was like to not have the obsession of the mind and the craving in the body. And I never had that before. I didn't know what that was. Is it any wonder why I held on for dear life to my food? Because I had absolutely zero concept of what it is like to live without the monkey on my back. Did you say 5 minutes? Thank you, dear. I wondered who was timing me. I figured there'd be a hook come out sooner or later. Oh, there, Suzanne's got the hook. I'll speed it up. So I was bitching out of one side of my mouth, and the other side was saying, let's do this another day. This feels pretty good. Let's do it another day. And I'm like, what is this? Now I have to swallow my pride and say these people are right? Oh, my God. Please. And the other part of me is like, thank God, look at how you feel. Because there were some very brief instances in my life where I woke up mornings. I'm not being funny here. There were mornings I woke up without the compulsion. And it scared the daylights out of me. I felt like I was missing something. It was like drinking a cup of decaf coffee. You know what it's like with the caffeine, but when you don't have the caffeine in it, it's different. How do you deal with this? There's no kick. And what I've come to understand is this program lets me live life without having to have a kick, because life is a kick. A spiritual connection is the ultimate kick. Connection with a higher power, power bigger than me, whatever that is. And I've learned also, in keeping with our theme, that gratitude vibrates higher than fear. Science has determined that we are all literally made of frequency and vibration. The table is vibrating slowly, more slowly than we are, but we're physical form. But the vibrations are different. That's why we can't put our hand through the podium. That idea of vibration holds for everything seen and unseen. Never got that, wouldn't have had the presence of mind to even think about that. But it stands to reason. It's all frequency. Radio waves are going through you and me, right? We can't see them, but if we have the right tuner, we can pick it up. If I got a clear tuner, I can be in conscious contact with the vibration of spirit. And every one of you. And suddenly I'm no longer in solitude or loneliness. Suddenly I'm connected with my sisters and brothers in recovery. Suddenly I'm feeling a deep sense of gratitude and I can feel the love in the room. And suddenly I feel things I could never feel before, along with the reassurance that if I work this program, I can find a solution that's beyond anything I can conceive of. And oh, by the way, I get to live in a normal size body and fit in a nice pair of jeans. So I just say, if you're skeptical about this, thank you. I understand completely. If you feel like you're stepping into some abyss, I get it. You don't have to do it because somebody tells you to do it. Let your life be an experiment. But I will say this, you are worth whatever it takes to have peace around the food. Live your life as an experiment, learn, and know. Because now I know beyond a shadow of a doubt, I accept these as requirements for my recovery. Not because somebody put a jackboot on my neck and said, you're going to do this. Because I'd have told them to, well, we won't say what I would tell them. But it works. It works, and I tried it. And for me, I know it is my truth. And I wish you all that blessing and ongoing gifts that this program gives you. And if you don't find it here, I trust that higher power will bring you what you need because higher power did that for me. And God don't play favorites. Thanks for letting me share.